Advent is a time of preparation for the coming of the Christ child, heralding his life, resurrection, and eventual return. On today's program, we reflect with Father Bernard O'Connor of the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches on some of the saints who were remembered during Advent. Today, Father Bernie takes us east to Damascus, the birthplace of St. John Damascene, and farther still to India, where St. Francis Xavier spent his missionary years.
St. John Damascene, we have a saint who was probably born in Damascus. There was certainly a very strong concept of Damascus as being already central in the life of Christianity. Namely, we associate that name with St. Paul. St. Paul having a little tumble from a horse and a very interesting life-changing experience. Where was he headed to?
Damascus.
Damascus, exactly. So there's no question that Damascus was a very clearly eastern metropolis and very important at the time. Now, St. Francis Xavier was quite western. We see him teaming up with the great St. Ignatius of Loyola and other colleagues, which began the Jesuit order, so very important to the church. But where did all that happen? Basically in Paris, at a place called the Collège de Sainte-Barbe in Paris. They meet, and the rest becomes history. But where did St. Francis Xavier eventually do missionary work? Well, among the main places, India. And then he heads to Japan, and he died while en route to China. So very definitely an Eastern Asian connection. So the name for Eastern is appropriate and rather endeared to me, who's from Eastern Canada. My alma mater was St. Francis Xavier University. There is a wonderful story, perhaps a bit apocryphal, told of St. Ignatius meeting him on the steps of Paris at the college and saying, "Young man, I have a question for you. What are you going to do? What are you studying? Oh, I want to be a lawyer. And then what? Oh, I want to go into politics. And then what? Well, I'm going to marry a very wealthy woman, and I'm going to become quite successful. And then what?" And Francis became extremely agitated by this surly questioner, who was really challenging him, and says, "Well, I suppose I'll just die." Which came the next question, "And then what?" And from that, Francis, a very intelligent mind, begins to think about the "and then what." And he goes searching for this Ignatius fellow. Oh, my. And then they team up with men called Pierre Favre, and you have four others coming along eventually. And this little band becomes the nucleus of the Order of the Jesuits. So Xavier was one of the first recruits of the great St. Ignatius. But don't you love the style of the question? Advent is a time when we prepare for the second coming of Christ. It announces not his December 25th celebration of Nativity, but his return to us. And what really St. Ignatius and thereby St. Francis Xavier are saying to us is a very important "and then what?" And that's our Advent theme.
What did Francis Xavier bring to the Orient? I mean, it should be quite important for you working there at the Congregation for Oriental Churches. You must have a feeling for Francis Xavier.
Thank you for saying that. This is a very interesting question. Francis was extremely responsible and responsive concerning human need. For example, in the case of going to Goa, well, the Portuguese, for better or for worse, were rather ensconced there at the time. And there was a request from the King of Portugal, John III, "Would you go to the East Indies? Would you travel about and perceive what has to be done, but would you function as a kind of a chaplain for Portuguese who are already there?" So this was an intent. And of course, he wanted to know, Francis, that is, what was the state of the local people? He had heard that they had received the gospel through St. Thomas the Apostle back in apostolic times. And Francis wondered, was this being preserved and kept alive really? What was the influence of the Portuguese upon these already well-formed Christians? And were there parts of the country, as he had heard, where the gospel had not yet reached? So he wandered around, literally, ministering to Portuguese soldiers and Westerners there, interacting with the what we call Malabar Malankara Catholics today, their ancestors, and also evangelizing and doing mission work among the very poorest, the pearl fishermen on the coast, people who were utterly impoverished, lived in grass huts, as he describes them. And he became deeply moved by their desire to learn who is your God.
Because at that time, and sure enough as well today, India is primarily a Hindu population.
Yes. And not only Hindu, more so at that time, with the traditional Hinduism being very much as you described, there was an emergence of a lot of kind of natural sects. We would call them animist and totemist, these types of realities, which simply means that they were very grounded in a primitive religious expression, tied to worshipping images, totems as they're called, or believing that the spirits were everywhere. And St. Francis knew that they were inherently religious. And he thought by bringing the gospel of Christ to them, they could develop that natural religious awareness into something truly Christian. And he was right, he proved it. But his challenges, which certainly fascinate me, were with the Westerners, the Portuguese who were there particularly, who did not behave in the most moral and admirable sense. They took advantage of the people, they exploited them, they took advantage of their sexuality as well as their resources. And to Francis' mind, this was one of the greatest troubles he faced. And then within the local populations, he was a Westerner, he was treated with suspicion. And he had to work through many, many difficulties to obtain the confidence of the people. And sometimes with success and sometimes not. But he traveled many, many, many miles, lived in terribly destitute conditions, suffered personal torments physically and mentally, and sustained in his faith. And there's an Advent lesson for us today.
What about his legacy? I mean, you go back very frequently to India. You are familiar with the church there. What would you say is the legacy of what he was able to bring to India?
Within the work that I do for the Congregation of Eastern Churches, my main emphasis is upon the Malabar Malankara tradition. Francis Xavier is considered to be an apostle of Latins, though he certainly interacted with the Eastern Christians from these traditions. But we still see evidence of his emphasis upon intense conversion to Christ that must manifest itself in apostolic zeal, a people willing not to be passive in their faith, but to be very active, outgoing, vibrant, and willing to participate in the mission of the church. That's one trait that still endures profoundly among the Indian people, Christian people of all three churches, three rites within the church. That legacy is manifest. The importance of personal and private development in faith, that you work within the community to discover your identity. You don't go to the faith community and try to take from it without a willingness to be dynamic within it. And that mentality persists. His emphasis on education. As I mentioned to you, I think my undergraduate years were spent at a university dedicated to St. Francis Xavier, and dedicated because of his emphasis while in India upon the importance of higher education. That not only do you basically instruct the people in the minimum of the faith, you teach them about their place in the world, which means respect for the natural, normal, scientific, and secular world of the time. And we have a responsibility to reach out that the church is well aware of today. So there's an extensive legacy, an enduring legacy, and a wonderfully positive legacy.
And the legacy also, we mentioned him before, but St. John Damascene was also a great scholar with interest in all kinds of fields, in science, in the arts, in music, in astronomy, so many yes. different interests. And he is one of the doctors of the church, whom we celebrate now at Advent time.
And appropriately so. Because one of the things which I love about St. John Damascene, now he's at a much earlier time frame. Francis Xavier was born in 1506, and St. John Damascene probably about 676. But what's interesting of him, and I'm so glad you mentioned about him being declared a doctor of the church very appropriately, he said continually in his writings, and this is wonderful, I'm not an original thinker. I am a compiler. I am a person who's as if writing an encyclopedia. I gather and collate and present in a comprehensive synthesis what has come before me to me. And this is something I think that the Catholic Church has a wonderful record to our credit. We're very interested in conserving the deposit of faith, but at the same time going so much deeper into it in terms of how various theological and other questions relate. But this was a man who had great respect for the development of tradition, for what we would call the development of doctrine, respect for the various fields of learning and how they integrated and could be reconciled with the Christian message, including, as you said, astronomy and what we would call the natural sciences. But as a compiler who preserved and safeguarded what he received with integrity, that would certainly make him a doctor, a teacher worthy of the title.
Now, if I recall correctly, he was born to an Arab Christian family.
Correct.
In Damascus. It was the time when the Muslims were ruling Damascus and
yes.
that area. And of course, if you're looking at the map of that region, Damascus, Syria today, is not very far from the Holy Land, from Jerusalem, from the places where Jesus himself walked and died. What does that tell us now?
In my congregation, every year, the prefect issues a letter to the Christians of the world, which is read usually on or near Good Friday, and a collection is taken up to assist the needs of Christians in the Holy Land. And it's something that I'm extremely delighted to be associated with in my formal work. Well, in terms of St. John Damascene, what we learn is the importance of the Christian community maintaining its identity. We learn the importance of the Christian community entering into a positive dialogue and a positive sense we have a mission and we have a possibility of a vocation within a broader context that is not Christian and that we can coexist and add to the well-being of each other. But we must first support each other. I'll give you an example. It's interesting that the father of John Damascene was what we would call chief financial officer for the caliph of the time. So we see immediately the contact with non-Christian and how they could work out a congenial relationship to the benefit of both. The son, John Damascene, continues the exact same thing. In fact, he was what we would call the chief counselor of Damascus. So obviously there's a spirit of coexistence, of being able to benefit one another, of a sense of respect for the integrity of each other. That is in the very history of the life of John Damascene. It is in the history of the presence of Christians today in the Middle East. It's in the history of the Good Friday Collection. And these lessons are worth recalling, I think, today. Tolerance, yes. Respect, yes. And a desire to further the good that is inherently in each person.
Now, St. John Damascene of Damascus, he was quite an influential part, as you said, of creating the doctrine of the church, or at least compiling the doctrine of the church. He went about that in various studies, didn't he?
Very much so, and under various difficulties, even relating to the Christian community, for example. He ran at odds with leaders of the time who were concerned about how the church should venerate images. For example, we call that the iconoclastic movement. It was a terrible torture for this poor man. And there was what we call a pseudo-synod, a false synod of Constantinople, in 754 to be precise, in which the Christian emperor of the period had him condemned. And the personal hurt of a man being condemned for his belief, he simply had another interpretation of images, which did not interpret them as blasphemous or as contradictory to scripture or as alien to Christian tradition. And because he took that stance and dared to be politically correct, he lost everything. He was condemned by a synod. And it wasn't until what we call the Seventh Council of Nicaea, rather, in 787, that he was exonerated.
But by that time, he was no longer, wasn't he?
Well,
or no?
You know, he dies in 787.
Okay.
The Council of the Seventh Council of Nicaea is held in 787. There's speculation as to whether he received its result, but there was building up to it a belief that that council would most definitely exonerate him, and of that we know he was aware. Whether he saw the final acta, the final result of the council, is uncertain. But it's interesting for me that he could have been very politically correct. most of the bishops and religious leaders of the time were, and they would concede to whatever the state asked of them. In the very same way that Pope Benedict today, in our time frame, in fact very recently, has addressed various lay groups saying, you must be responsible and active within the political processes of your countries in order for the Christian message to be able to reach organizations and institutions that may not otherwise be disposed to us. Put aside political corrections, he's really saying. Well, John Demosthene indicates that beautifully within his life and his vocation. And I think this is a critical lesson for us too.
Father Bernard O'Connor is an official with the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches.